Good afternoon. My name's Nicole Aberdee. I'd like to start this afternoon's session by acknowledging that this land that we meet on today is the traditional land for the Kaurna people and that I respect their spiritual relationship with their country. I also acknowledge the Kaurna people as the custodians of the Adelaide region and that their cultural and heritage beliefs are still as important to the living Kaurna people today. Welcome to this session where I am lucky enough to be in conversation with acclaimed Australian writer Anna Funder about her fourth book, Wifedom, published in Australia by Penguin Random House in 2023. Before I introduce Anna, could you please all switch your mobile phones to silent? Let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Anna Funder. She's one of our most beloved writers. She has honours degrees in arts and law, an MA from Melbourne University, and a PhD in creative writing from the University of Technology in Sydney. Originally trained as a human rights lawyer, in the 1990s she left the law to live in Berlin and write full time. In 2002, her first book, Stasiland, was published. In 2004, it won the highly prestigious Samuel Johnson Prize for best non-fiction in the English-speaking world. In 2011, her first novel, All That I Am, was published. It won numerous prizes, including the 2012 Miles Franklin Prize, the Barbara Jeffress Prize, and the Australian Book Industry Book of the Year. Both books have been translated into many languages and have been international bestsellers. In 2011, the Sydney Morning Herald named her in its top 100 people of influence. Wifedom, as I say, was published here in July last year. It's also been published in the UK and in the US. The New York Times described it as a bravura analysis of female invisibility. The Guardian in the UK called it a painstaking work of restoration and a vital portrait of a woman whose unseen work was instrumental in the creation of books that became cornerstones of 20th century literature. Wifedom, I'm delighted to say, appeared in several lists of the best books of 2023, including the Financial Times, The Economist, The Times, The Telegraph, The Guardian Australia, and it was a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. And most exciting of all, Wifedom was recently longlisted for the inaugural Women's Prize for Nonfiction in the UK, with the winner to be announced in London in June. Please make Anna welcome. Anna, my heading for our introduction is, why this book? Why now? You didn't start out wanting to write about George Orwell. You'd always loved his writing. You didn't start out wanting to write about his wife, Eileen. You'd always loved George Orwell's writing. And in 2017, you found yourself in a lovely bookshop in Sydney where you picked up a book of essays by George Orwell and you reread them. You then read the six Orwell biographies that had been written by men, that's significant, between the 1970s and 2003. What diverted you from George Orwell to his wife, Eileen O'Shaughnessy?
Thank you, Nicole. Thank you for that lovely introduction. It's so nice to be here in Adelaide with you all. It's such a treat. Thank you for having me. It's also a kind of bizarrely narcissistic experience because there's all these flags along here with my initials on them. And everywhere I look, it's that. I don't know what that says. It's nothing good. It's not so much I found myself in a bookshop in 2017 as I found myself in my local shopping mall, which is where I spend a lot of time. I've spent a lot of my child-rearing years behind a pram or a trolley in a shopping mall. And I think I went to the bookshop to try and, just as a reprieve from the shopping mall, I won't name the brand name supermarket, but anyway, I spent a lot of time there. And I picked up Orwell's collected essays, letters and journalism. And as you say, I read my way through that. And that was really an experience in reading how Orwell constructed his writing persona, his writing self, if you like. And that's hugely interesting in itself and hugely interesting for me because I think that was a moment in my life where I thought, what has happened to my writing self behind this pram/trolley, wherever I found myself? And then I did read these biographies, the six of them, and they are magisterial. They are fantastic. I would recommend them. I read them with great pleasure. But after I'd finished that, I still wasn't cured. I wasn't quite sure what I was looking for. I think it was something like, subconsciously, I thought, Orwell is so good at coming, looking at power structures from an underdog point of view. And for some amorphous reason, even as the most kind of privileged, if perimenopausal woman, white woman in Sydney behind this trolley, I just thought maybe some of his insights into how power works will be useful for me. But so I read my way through these biographies, and then when I finished them, I wasn't cured. And so I kept reading. And I came across, this wasn't my original discovery in archives, but I came across six letters from Eileen O'Shaughnessy, George Orwell's first wife, to her best friend from college days at Oxford together, where they read English. Eileen read English under Tolkien, and she was there with Stephen Spender, and she was an enormously brilliant English student. And she was writing during her marriage to her friend Nora. These letters were discovered in, Nora had no children, in Nora's nephew's garage, I think, in a crate after Nora died in 2005. So they were not part of the biographies that I'd read. And they date from the beginning of the marriage to Orwell in 1936 to the end of that marriage in 1945. And the first of them I will never tire of quoting because I love it so much, but also because it's the moment, the kind of, you know, coup de foudre lightning moment where I thought, I have to do something with this woman. Eileen is writing to Nora after she's been married to Orwell for 6 months, just going on 6 months, and they have been living in a tiny cottage in a village called Wallington, 50 miles out of London. The cottage is a kind of two-up, two-down medieval affair with, I guess, medieval plumbing and sanitation. So it had no electricity, one cold tap, a fireplace, an outdoor loo. It was enormously primitive. And she'd been doing all the domestic work, but also quite a lot of intellectual work. So working very hard during this marriage. I have to say, when they got married, she, in what I think of as the first radical act of the editing genius that would come to define the marriage, deleted the word obey from her wedding vows. Orwell couldn't credit her with that. He wrote to a friend, the vicar left it out. Anyway, so there's this woman who won't obey, is working like a navvy and a scholar in this hovel, writing for the first time to her best friend at the end of 1936, and she writes, Dear Nora, I'm sorry it's taken me so long to write to you, but we have quarrelled so continuously and really bitterly since the wedding that I thought I'd just write one letter to everyone once the murder or separation was accomplished. So it's not really possible to read that, having read my way through Orwell and through six biographies, and not to think, wow, who is she? And also, I kind of love her. And what was going on in this marriage? What were they quarrelling about as she was getting used to her new job in the role of a wife? And why is it that having read all these biographies, I know nothing about her? So I turn back to the biographies and I get to the bit where they're just married. And the biographers write things like, the earliest days of his marriage were the happiest for George. He was never happier again. He was more happy than he would ever be again. And conditions were idyllic for him. And I just thought, wow. So this is how it's done. This is the magic trick of wifedom, how women and our work and lives are made invisible, and it involves the passive voice. Conditions were made without a maker. So someone has done the work. but they are then literally written out of the story. So that's a long answer to your question, but that's how it happened.
And Anna, you say that I love that you then went to the sources listed in the biographies. You continued your investigative work in that way, and there were original letters and original documents, and you wanted to investigate how, I love this expression, how a woman can be erased first by domesticity and then by history. So you've talked about those methods of omission, in particular the use of the passive voice. Let's go back now and let's talk a little bit about who Eileen was. So they met in 1935. George Orwell was 32. She was 29. They married in 1936. Tell us a little bit, as at 1936, about what their respective backgrounds were, who they were as at that date.
Yes. So Eileen met George. This is all in the book, so you'll be, if you have had a look at it, you'll know this story. She was studying for a master's in psychology at UCL in London. Orwell, actually, just parenthetically, was very nervous about her psychological expertise. She was studying things like psychopathology, word association, and things like that that made him very antsy when he found out about them. Her friend, who was studying psychology, Lydia, with her, took her to a party in Hampstead. And they went there and they met, in Lydia's words, at this party. This is at Orwell's share flat. He was sharing with two other women, one also studying psychology and the other studying medicine. And Lydia said, "We met these two rather moth-eaten men draped over the fireplace." She was very unimpressed. But my impression is that really for Orwell it was pretty much love at first sight, or love at first conversation. And 3 weeks later, Eileen said to Lydia, "One of those moth-eaten men proposed to me."
Because he said that after she left the party. What did he say to his friend that was holding the party?
Yeah, so after, he insisted on, at this party, Eileen said of herself at that party, "Oh, I was behaving, I was quite drunk, behaving my worst, very rowdy." So obviously he found that quite attractive. He insisted on walking Lydia and Eileen to the bus stop, and he came back and he said to Rosalind, who was this older divorced woman studying, who became quite a prominent psychoanalyst, said to her, "That is the woman I want to marry." Which was so unusual for her that she remembered those words all her life, really. But Eileen, when she said to Lydia 3 weeks later, "One of those moth-eaten men proposed to me," Lydia was absolutely horrified and said, "Well, what did you say?" And she said, Eileen said, "Well, basically he just, he was talking about why he wasn't really eligible at the same moment that he was proposing. So I just let him talk on."
So he wasn't a well-known writer at that stage, Anna, was he?
He was completely unknown. He was completely unknown. And one of the things that the biographers say, again, about his work, connecting his work with the marriage, is that somehow, mysteriously, whether by coincidence or influence, quote unquote, his work got much better as soon as they were married. So he came from a family that he famously described as lower upper middle class. But actually that looks self-deprecating, like so much about Orwell. But I went to the family house when I was in the UK last year on tour, which was a wonderful thing. His mother inherited some money from her relatives who lived in Burma, and in retirement his family was finally able to afford to purchase a house in the UK, and it was a very modest house in a seaside town in South Wales. So my sense was, when he said he was lower upper middle, it was less self-deprecating than kind of popping himself somewhere in the upper middle where he probably really wasn't. Eileen came, I don't pretend to understand the stratification of British society particularly well, but Eileen came from a family that was much wealthier, and obviously she had this extraordinary education at Oxford and he hadn't been to university. So we're looking at a couple where he stands to gain a great deal and she is taking a great risk on an unknown moth-eaten man.
And she's in the middle of doing a master's. She's got the first degree from Oxford already, which she's done very well in.
Yes.
She's got a good job and she's started the master's degree. Okay. I want to talk about what you discovered about him and their marriage in three different categories. First, what George was like as a husband. I'd like you to talk about what you discovered about his infidelities. Second, about the way he played down her role during the Spanish Civil War. And third, about the fact that he never gave her proper acknowledgement for her assistance with his work. And I'd like to focus specifically on Animal Farm. So let's start with him, first of all, as a husband, and let's talk a bit about his infidelities. What did you learn, Anna?
Yes, it's kind of hard looking back at a marriage of 80 years ago. Although I think we should do it, it's a little bit like I went to see Barbie recently, a movie I adored, and I particularly liked the way it posits two worlds, one in which women are central and powerful and can do anything, and the other, which is the real world, which is different from that. And I think something like that goes on when we look at the past 80 years ago, when we look at marriages, domestic relations, women's situation 80 years ago, and we look now. We're looking at how far we've come, and we're looking also at where we need to go further. But some people close to Orwell have said to me, oh, it's not legitimate, really, to look back on this marriage. And I disagree with that enormously because I'm looking back at it as a way of having a little bit of distance on a kind of extreme version of gender relations in a marriage that makes it clearer how that worked and what was considered perhaps normal or normal enough for none of the biographers to comment on it right up until the 2000s. So that's what I'm looking at. It's a little bit like saying, well, let's look at slavery. We need to do that from a contemporary point of view where we give the enslaved person the benefit of our sense of their full humanity, which was denied them in that system, rather than saying, oh, there was nothing to see there because people at the time thought that was okay. It wasn't okay then. And neither was this kind of marriage. So that's just to preface coming at it from today's point of view. But that said, I find it really hard to look at because it may have been the case for people in general or for people in the arts or for men in general or for people of that class or I don't know, to be sort of bed hopping. I don't know. I kind of don't judge it. What I'm more interested in is the way that Orwell is what the biographers say. He perfects the quote-unquote Orwell pounce.
Terrifying, Anna.
Yes. He was 6'2". So he does quite a lot of this extramarital pouncing at parties and in parks and in workplaces and so on. But for me, I was looking at it from Eileen's point of view and it's a curious thing to look at that level of intimacy in a marriage and I really didn't want to go there. And I thought I would hate someone, Orwell would hate someone to look at his so-called private life. I would hate someone to look at mine.
For different reasons, Anna.
For different reasons. Yeah, probably. Yes, definitely. But then I came across something that Orwell wrote in his last literary notebook as he was dying of TB. And he wrote this very kind of difficult to digest thing. He was writing truthful things about himself in the third person, as if to sort of distance himself from them. And he wrote, "The thing that they, I don't know who they is, don't tell you about women, especially wives, is about their disgusting filthiness and their sexual voracity." He says, in every marriage of more than a year's standing, it's always the woman who wants sex more and more and always the man who is trying to get out of it, more and more aware that his wife is despising him for his lack of virility. So once I read that, I just thought, well, his private life then suddenly looked like an area in which Eileen lived and worked and possibly suffered, where it was legitimate for me to go in and have a look at what it was like for her. And I thought at first, well, it was probably too much cleaning and not enough or not good enough sex. So that opened up the marriage for me.
And I love the way in with that. I just want to take you to this passage because you do it so beautifully. Describe how his male biology... I mean, it's a truly shocking passage to read. It absolutely is gobsmacking. And I love the way you write about how his male biographers deal with that piece of writing. Do you want to just talk about that?
Oh, yes. Well, it's obviously a disturbing and kind of tragic, really, thing to write. It raises questions. Orwell was deeply homophobic, which was remarked on by his friends. You know, his friend William Empson, among others, William Empson said, the author of Seven Types of Ambiguity, he said, you know, we were puzzled by his immense homophobia. For most of us on the left who loved the workers, when we were younger, we did it practically, you know. So they're much less kind of coy about it. Another man said he thought that Orwell was aware inside himself of something deeply repellent to him. His closest relationships and the people to whom he seems to have been most attracted were definitely men and boys. So the pouncing starts to look both predatory and unsatisfactory to him, you know, and disturbing. So, but the biographers don't really want to examine his possible homosexuality.
Or misogyny.
So they say, oh, this was probably a fantasy, these words, or possibly he was trying out something for fiction. So they put doubt on it or fictionalise it or say that... So they're trying to deal with evidence that's very difficult to deal with by trivialising it, doubting it, or turning it into a fiction. And I think it needs to be taken seriously. I have to say, the thing that about the marriage you're talking... I mean, we're just talking about infidelity. I think really other people's marriages are their own and they make their own arrangements. But what was interesting to me wasn't so much the infidelity... It was the pouncing and kind of unsatisfactory nature of it for him and for the women. But it was also the fact that he wanted Eileen to know about it. So it was like a power grab within the marriage. And that involved certain kinds of very basic cruelties. Mm. So when they're in Morocco, when he's recovering from a tubercular hemorrhage, they're in a tiny village and the teenage... daughter of the innkeeper, he finds very attractive, this girl. And so he says to Eileen, he wants to have a Moroccan girl. Can he have one? So that's, the biographers say, oh, he was asking her for permission. And therefore, in his mind at least, the marriage was declared open. So the biographers rewrite this marriage as an open marriage, which therefore assumes a woman's consent, which they have invented retrospectively in history, to kind of so that she forgives him, no harm done, therefore all the pouncing, including on Moroccan girls and whoever else, is okay. I do not read it that way. And so wifedom is about how not only that happened to Eileen in her life, but then it was written over, not only by Orwell, but by the biographers as well. Yeah. And there's another very, very, I leave it as a non-spoiler, a very extreme example of him trying to do that again in London with one of Eileen's close friends and to let her know that that was happening. Mm. So these behaviours need to be looked at and they haven't been before because they're very telling about a human being.
And Anna, as you say, what really struck you was how the male biographers did. Like, I mean, I don't think they tried to deny the infidelities, but the way they dealt with them. I mean, they quoted one of them saying, "Whatever Eileen knew, she was obviously prepared to tolerate." You didn't find any evidence for that at all.
No, that's a fiction. It really came to me to seem that the biographers, sometimes very consciously and sometimes possibly not consciously, you know, naturally they're in love with their subject. I understand that feeling. But they were really trying to minimize both what he needed from women and what he got from women and what women gave him, which was enormous, and then what he did to women. And they're trying to do that to create a fiction of a decent, in his own words, man who did everything himself, who was a solo genius who did everything himself. So one tiny thing is that you read the biographies. It's not a tiny thing at all, actually. You read them and you understand that he is descended from a long line of Blairs, Scottish Blairs. You know, one of the forefathers was a slave-owning Blair who made lots of money, and then the money was lost, and then his grandfather went into the clergy and had lots of children who hated him, and then one of them was Orwell's father, so on and so forth. You don't understand that Orwell's mother and aunt were feminists, educated feminists, suffragettes, and Fabians, so they were left-wing. So Orwell is growing up in a female-led household where, you know, his aunt ran a literary salon in London to which H.G. Wells came and other luminaries of the day. But you don't find any of that out from the biographies. And for a man who grows up to be a left-wing writer, literary person, seeing things from the point of view of an underdog, that feminist, intellectual, left-wing inheritance is the important inheritance. But you learn nothing about it because, consciously or unconsciously, those women who are so formative are left out, and it looks as if he's made himself. The same thing applies to Eileen. So it seemed to me in the end that the biographies, much as I'd loved them, were writing fictions of and by omission. Mm. And my job was to write, in a way, a fiction of inclusion, you know, to go and pick up all these scraps of material that they had left out, denied, doubted, stuck into endnotes or footnotes, and bring them up and see the story of this marriage through Eileen's eyes and bring her back to life.
So let's turn to the second real thing that you discovered, the Spanish Civil War, her significant work and her courage. You make the point in his memoir on his experiences during the Spanish Civil War, Homage to Catalonia, he mentions her 37 times, but never by name. And you say you yourself had read this book quite a few times, and it hadn't really occurred to you that she was there. So I'd like you to tell us what you discovered about Eileen and her role and her courage during the Spanish Civil War.
Yes. So it was kind of like a detective hunt, you know, writing this book. My husband, who was enormously supportive and patient, used to compare me. We watched, I don't know if some of you will know, there's a wonderful series called Homeland on television, and he compared me to, I don't think he meant it as a compliment. He compared me to Carrie in Homeland, who is the bipolar, obsessive, who is trying to find the invisible spy in the midst of the CIA, and he thought that was what I was doing. And I had this kind of notice board full of red threads and you know, pictures of people, yes, I was trying to pin together. But yeah, he's
brave and courageous as well, Emma.
Totally got a point. Harry. Yes, obsessed. Yes, and I feel when I was writing Spain, I'm so relieved that. Well, that people like this section, because I didn't really know what I was doing, and it took me longer to piece together what Eileen was doing and what was really happening in Spain than they actually spent in Spain. So by the time I'd spent X many months there, I was already, kind of embarrassed and behind. I felt behind the eight ball. But really, you can read Homage to Catalonia, which is brilliant and fun, and I recommend it, and not realised that Eileen was there, and you can read the biographies and not realise that she was there too. So one of the relatively recent biographers says, Eileen, this Orwell goes to Spain just after he's written the murder or Eileen has written the murder or separation letter, and he wants to go and fight fascists, which is, you know, fair enough, the right thing to do, and he wants to write about it. A biographer says things like, Eileen, who was not political at all, followed her husband to Spain, because she thought that from Barcelona she would be able to procure for him treats like margarine, chocolate and cigars to send to the front from time to time.
So what did she actually do, Anna? Tell us what she actually
did. So she went to... She got a job at the International Labour Party headquarters in Barcelona, which was the HQ of the party that Orwell was fighting for. Orwell was off literally in a hole in the ground in Aragon, in an area where there wasn't much fighting, an area I visited actually with the son that he and Eileen adopted in 1944. I visited in 2017. And she was at the epicentre of what was going on politically. So she was responsible for propaganda, writing the propaganda for radio and print broadcasts with her boss, who was an American economist in that office, for supply and communications to the British men at the front. So she knew everything that was going on. She was handling all their letters and she was handling all their needs and getting what they needed. She visited the front. When Orwell was so bored that he was literally sticking his head up above the trench trying to find a bullet to hit him, and he was eventually successful and a bullet went right through his throat. He narrowly escaped death. He spends, for instance, 2,500 words describing the fairly abysmal medical treatment in field hospitals during the war. 2,500 words, which she would have edited and typed, without describing the mentioning the fact that within 48 hours of the injury, she was at the front managing all that medical treatment and caring for him and looking after him. And then she suffered a Stalinist raid there. All of this was there possibly for the... Well, not possibly, certainly the biographers could have found it. And one would have thought that if he's at war and writes about it and she is at the HQ in a political job, that would be interesting and that you might follow up what she was actually doing. But none of them did. So I did.
Where did you find it, Anna?
Well, eventually it was like reversing... I sort of reverse engineered... Homage to Catalonia. So I looked at every time something happened, but it happened in the passive voice, Orwell's, or something happened which was described as having already happened so that it was able to be described in the past tense. These are ways of having things happen. A manuscript was typed or was saved or the passports were saved. Actually, he describes how Eileen saved their passports and checkbook from a Stalinist police raid. She hides them under the mattress because she knows a raid is going to happen. He's away. Six Stalinist policemen come into her hotel room and search it for 2 hours, and she stays in bed the whole time, sitting on these precious documents. Orwell, that is one thing that he does describe without ever naming her. But the reason that he tells that story is that he wants to say that even when they're being controlled by Russian Stalinist operatives, these policemen were still Spanish, and the Spanish are so inherently decent, an Orwellian word, that it was too much for them to turf a woman out of bed. But he doesn't say, my wife had the foresight to hide these documents. She must have had some highly developed interpersonal intelligence that she can put these six men who are terrorising her at ease so that they don't turf her out of bed. Or what that might have been like for her. His imagination does not extend to that.
Anna, what about that, the amazing story where she, I mean, she literally saves his life, where she's sitting downstairs in the hotel lobby and she's worried. They're ready to pounce when he walks in the door. So tell us about that. I mean, that's just one of many instances of extraordinary courage. You've just spoken of another.
Yes. In the end, what happened in Spain was that Stalin, who... was obviously running Russia, had been apparently supporting the anti-fascist effort, so the communist effort in Spain. But there were many different splinter parties in Spain, one of which Orwell was fighting for, the PUM, which was affiliated with the ILP, the British ILP. And Stalin basically did not, for geopolitical reasons, he wanted to kind of be friends with the French, who didn't want a communist regime on their doorstep in Spain. And Stalin didn't want any kind of socialist regime in Europe that he didn't run or control. So he routed this revolution. And that involved street fights, machine gun fire, killings and arrest of lots and lots of people in May, June 37. And during that time, I'm actually going to leave it to you to read the book to see this story.
It's just one Eileen of the most exciting episodes. Life. It's just absolutely fantastic. So more than that, so first of all, there's all of that bravery and all of that courage and all of that work during the Spanish Civil War that he doesn't acknowledge. But it continues. When they get back to London and she becomes the breadwinner for them, and that's not acknowledged either. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Eileen was partway through this degree in psychology when they were married, when they got married. And so the biographer says she gave it up. They're a little bit nervous about why. I don't know exactly why. She doesn't leave an account of why. He doesn't leave an account of why. The sensible thing would have been for her to finish that degree, like so many of her women friends, and then to go on and have a career in psychoanalysis or psychotherapy or psychology. But it didn't happen. And the sort of Orwell's letters, he's saying in this very traditional way, I'm not sure that I can get married. Maybe I can't afford to keep a wife. But the fact of the marriage was she kept him financially. So you have a kind of cover story in patriarchy of women not working or being kept, which has only ever been partially true for some women of some classes at some times. Mostly women have worked, you know, in Britain largely as domestics, but sometimes, like Eileen, they would have had professional careers. She ends up working in London, I guess partly from her Oxford degree and connections and partly from her experience in a political office writing propaganda in Spain. She works for the Ministry of Censorship during the war in London in the Department of Information. And the Ministry of Censorship was in the, some of you may know this, kind of ziggurat-shaped building in Bloomsbury called Senate House. That was the building that Orwell took as the model for the Ministry of Truth in 1984. So she had sat up there in the Department of Censorship, you know, involved in censoring the news, a bit, I suppose, like Winston, a character that Orwell was later able to make, perhaps drawing on some of her experiences. And she hated that job, actually. And after that, she got a job in the Ministry of Food. And the Ministry of Food, she was a producer producing radio skits with the BBC for a daily programme which broadcast to the women of Britain how to feed your family with the scarce rations of wartime. And she had a lot of fun with radio stars of the day and writing sketches, one of which she may have voiced. It's hard to know. If you Google around enough in BBC archives, you can find it. But she had the good fortune to be very good friends there with a novelist who was so aptly named for someone who worked at the Ministry of Food. I couldn't put this in a novel, so it was lucky I was writing non-fiction. Her name was Lettice Cooper. And Lettice Cooper loved Eileen. She said, you know, when we first met her, we thought she was affected because we would say something to her and it took her such a long time to respond to us. And then we realised that it took her a long time because she was listening so deeply to what was said. And she was the sort of person who saw right through you as if your outside was a glass and what she saw were your feelings. So that is the skill, really, of a very empathetic and lovely person, but also of a novelist. Not that all novelists are empathetic and lovely people. But I think that's very revealing of Eileen's character, and I found that hugely interesting. And I think that George would have really appreciated that because, as even his closest friend said, Richard Rees, he was someone who never really understood anybody else's feelings.
Let's talk then about that third thing that you really uncovered, Anna, that her unacknowledged assistance with his work, in particular with Animal Farm. Would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So this is, you know, one of the sort of pretty perennial, hoary issues perhaps that wifed in the book raises is whether you can still love somebody's work when you find out who they were, who made it. I've had a lot of reader response to this book, and I've had a lot of particularly long and lovely letters from men, generally older men, and I think sometimes they come to this book from a long love of Orwell, and they read it and then this question is very much in their minds, but also for women. But they then say, you know, these are men who are wondering if in their own lives they have benefited from a system which is not their fault, in which the sort of invisible and unacknowledged labour of their partners, or in some cases former partners, they've written to me, was something that they benefited from and that was then a problem that created resentment. So for my own book, I'm hoping it's a kind of liberatory work, but also I feel very strongly that we have to, that Orwell's work is very important, and most particularly Animal Farm and 1984. Animal Farm, he thought, was his best work. It was written during the war in London when Eileen was working at the Ministry of Food, so we know a lot about how it was written because every single day she came into work and told letters and her other friends about the book in installments each day. Orwell wanted initially to write an anti-Stalinist essay, and Eileen, who'd just been working in censorship and who had a much better political sense than Orwell, said to him, you'll never get that published. Stalin is now helping us win the war against Hitler. That will not fly. So I don't know what the rest of that conversation was, but the idea of an essay was turned into this allegory, an animal fable, like the ones of, say, Tolkien or Chaucer that she'd studied at Oxford, a perfect animal fable about a Stalinist regime. So she worked all day at the ministry and shopped at lunchtime for food, went home and cooked. She was an excellent cook, apparently, for Orwell and everybody else who was staying or had been bombed out or had just come over. And then they would hop into bed together because they couldn't afford to heat the flat, and work on the book in installments night by night, which she then reported back. So he thought, as I said, it was his best book. It is a complete outlier in all of Orwell's work, which generally, as you'll know, has a completely different tone. So Orwell can be funny, but he's not whimsical, and he doesn't see other characters, and he certainly doesn't have developed female characters like there are in Animal Farm. And he generally has a stand-in, underdog, everyman kind of funny, grumpy Orwell character in the centre of his books. And Animal Farm is this lovely kind of group portrait of the animals in Stalinist revolution. So he said, after the marriage was over, to a friend, oh, it's a shame Eileen isn't around to see the publication of Animal Farm, because she even helped in the planning of it. So that is an example, I suppose, of the way that the enormous amount of work from initial idea through execution of a woman can be minimised as even helping in planning. Mm. Just on the political nous, I seem to have made a very sweeping statement about her political insight and compared to his. She once said of him, and I think she loved him in the way that love can be complicated and interesting and productive. She said, George has a remarkable political simplicity. This is coming from someone who has explained what's going on in Spain, you know, and then who explains that you will not get a Stalinist, anti-Stalinist published leaflet published in during the war and so on. And one of the biographers just couldn't manage that, and his name is Sir Bernard Crick, and he just rewrote Eileen's quote. Mm. So if you read his biography, he says, Eileen said, George has a remarkable political sympathy instead. So really, you know, me and Carrie and the Mad Detective Board, I was finding all of these snippets and then able to create a different picture of the marriage, a picture of this previously disappeared woman, and a much better account of how the works came to be and how they came to be so good. And I think it's completely possible to hold the woman and the marriage and the man and the work in your mind at the same time, even if perhaps it involves, to use an Orwellian term, doublethink.
Anna, that is a perfect segue into the next thing that I wanted to talk to you about, which is so interesting, and this issue of whether the moral failings of great writers should affect the way that we read them. So I know that you've been asked by a lot of people, does what you now know about Orwell affect your love of his work? And you've preempted that. I know you were very careful and you've written it in the book to say you don't want whatever you discover about him being a poor husband to lead to him being cancelled or to lead to people disregarding his work. And you say something terrific. You say, a person is not their work, just where it came from. To want them to be the same is a form of tyranny. Could you talk a little bit about that and your own? I mean, I've preempted it, but the answer to that question, now that you know all of this about what, basically, a poor husband he was, does it affect your enjoyment of his work?
I think to want them to be the same is a form of tyranny in a way, and then I write, and from there no art comes. My sense is that we project onto writers, if you love someone's work and it moves you, it's as if you've let them inside you and they've rearranged your mental furniture and played with your heart and left you with something lasting. That's a very intimate thing. You know, words are very powerful and they muck around with our thoughts and more with our emotions. So then we project onto writers who are all flawed, myself totally, particularly, and also, this image that we want them to be the person that we imagine them to be because they have had this effect on us, this intimate moving of us. And that's not possible. That's a reader fantasy, which I also share. If you look at 1984, which is an important work, you know, my kids studied it at school. That's still being given to 16 and 17-year-olds. On about, you know, very early on in that book, I reread it when one of my kids was doing it for HSC. Winston has a fantasy of raping a woman and slitting her throat at the moment of climax. So I don't think, I didn't remember that, and that's not the only time there's an act of kind of really violent misogyny by our hero. 1984 is paranoid, you know, it's prescient, it's important, it's violent, it's sadistic, and it's misogynist. All of those things and incredibly valuable. We live in a world of total surveillance that he couldn't have imagined. We have what he would have called telescreens in our pockets at all times. You know, the world is divided into warring blocks. I think it's a really important work. I think that for us to have a fantasy that the man who pulled from himself this important, if paranoid, violent, misogynist, sadistic, also excellent work, was not seeing those things in himself in order to project them onto the world is naive. And my exploration is to say this is who he really was, you know, and to expect him to be a sort of ordinary, hail fellow, well-met, decent, straight, everyman kind of character is a reader failure rather than a writer failure. We, myself included, I'm not anywhere, of course, putting myself in the same sentence as him, but we people write from our flaws as much as from whatever we might think are our talents. And I think that we need to put the error, not with the author who's totally flawed and allowed to be and must be, but with ourselves as readers for what we hope in superhero writers, you know?
Anna, I want to ask you... I'm just going to dig a little bit deeper with that.
You're clapping my flaws.
I'm going to dig a little bit deeper because I think it's really interesting the way you look at this. You take it, you suggest that perhaps one of the reasons, in fact, that he was such a great writer is actually not in spite of, but because of his flaws. And there's this great passage where you say, one of the things art can do is to show us safely things that are frightening, tyranny and sadism, for instance. To really go there An artist or writer needs to feel those things in their bones. You then go on to say that leaves open the question of whether the dark furnace within Orwell is the place from which the work comes. I found that really interesting. Are you saying that you think perhaps Orwell's writing is only as good as it is because of his imperfections?
I don't know. I can't kind of quantify it, but I think I said it better in the bit that you quote than I said it before, but it's essentially the same kind of thing, you know, where people, novelists and other writers are trying to, what we want from literature, what writers are kind of doing is revealing things that are unseen or unspoken, you know, like feelings, or at a political level, like this in wifedom, women and their lives, or the so-called private life of a man, which hides the life and work of a woman. So it's exciting to be... That's why exciting reading is so exciting, if it's done well, is that we're looking at things that are being made visible. And I think that if, you know, human beings are complex and we are all, you know, angels and devils at the same time. So to look at it properly, we need to acknowledge that that's where the writing is coming from too. I was in London last week and had lunch with a very wonderful writer friend of mine who's 90 years old, and we had this kind of conversation, and he said to me from his, I suppose, 70 years of experience, that he thought writers were particularly awful people.
Oh.
But I can't quantify it. So I just think it's worth acknowledging that if we want to see it in print, we can't expect the writer not to have been there before us to represent it to us.
I just think it's so interesting the way you explore that. Okay, my final few questions. We can't leave this stage without me asking you about patriarchy. Because there are two things you do in this book. You say, in explaining why you wrote Wifedom, you quote Orwell himself, where he says, "I write because there's some lie I want to expose, some fact to which I want to draw attention." So you wrote this book, certainly in part, to resurrect Eileen, which you've done magnificently, to write her back into history. But your book is also a powerful takedown of the patriarchy and how it operates to sublimate the ideas and the aspirations of women. And in particular, you touched on this earlier, how women's unpaid domestic and care work takes them away from other work, and how the unpaid work is undervalued. It takes them away from other work. You say, you go through, and the footnotes are fabulous, you cite all sorts of research, basically, that comes to the proposition, every society in the world is built on the unpaid or underpaid work of women. I expect a little applause at that. Anna nails it with the statistics. What I'm interested in is, and you talk about this earlier in the book, how does that impact upon you as a writer? And you say in that early stage of the book, I wish I had a wife like Eileen.
Yes. I think what I was really trying to do is look at, you know, quite a few things, but in a way, by finding Eileen, I also had to look at how she's been erased, and that made me think about the kind of ways in which women's work, not just domestic work, and certainly in her case, masses of domestic work, from, you know, chickens to goats to food to cleaning out the cesspit and so on, but also intellectual work, or, for instance, the intellectual kind of heritage that he had through his mother and aunt, looking at how that's made invisible. So these techniques like the passive voice or separating things in time, techniques that Orwell uses and the biographers use, I always wondered how that applies to us today, because if it is the case that the unpaid work of women, the UN estimates that if it had to be paid for, it would cost US $10.9 trillion a year to pay for the unpaid work of women that keeps families, societies and nations going. So we can't afford it, but we can't be without it. So how is it that this massively valuable thing is invisible, and what is the cost to women of doing the work and being invisible at the same time as you do it? So I suppose wifedom is a kind of an exercise in showing how that worked on one woman to show how possibly it is still happening today.
Mm. There's a lovely quote in Wifedom where you say that in writing it, you took your cue from Orwell. The project of good writing is perfectly combined with a political project. I love that. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
How
you combine those?
I suppose it goes back to what I'm saying about writing being a way almost magical to me of making invisible things visible and invisible people visible out of history. And that's a political act if you are also looking at the forces in society that rendered Eileen in this case, or, you know, I could have taken any great 20th century writer, male 20th century writer or artist, you could write essentially the same kind of book. So in the sense that I'm looking at the social forces that acted on this particular woman, it's a political act, an analysis, not that I'm really qualified to do that, but I think that, you know, that's what literature can do in a microcosm kind of way.
We've got time for a few questions. I think we've got 5 minutes left. The microphone will, I think, be in the centre of the aisle. If you have any questions, race to that microphone. We'll only have time for a few, I'm afraid. But if you'd like to ask Anna a question, please come forward to the microphone. Yes, please. Sorry.
Thank you. Anna, I've just finished reading your book and it was amazing. I have one major question, and perhaps it's a question that I've often asked myself and I've often asked it of friends of mine. Why didn't she murder him or separate from him?
I think love is complicated, thank goodness, and relationships are complicated and marriages are complicated. And I think she wanted to see what could be written. I think had she lived longer, she would probably have written on her own. I think Animal Farm probably gave her some confidence. That's my reading of it. It's true that she could have left him any time. She had a beautiful home to go to at her brother's and so on. So I think she had a capacity for hard work and seeing things through that many women share. She was of a class where she really would have been no shame or not all that much difficulty to leave him. So there must have been something that she was curious about or stuck in. Who knows why women stay in general?
Hi, thanks for all your efforts and for being here, Anna. Just a question. I did my degree last year in creative writing. And there was a young man in my class who had a character who demonstrated racist issues. And I remember the tutor taking him aside and sort of telling him off and suggesting that that's just not going to be accepted. And the young man was so confused because he said, "But that's not me, that's my character." And I think we need to be a little careful. Sometimes, sure, with Orwell, we can see the likeness with his character in his books. But at what point does an author not write about something? I mean, they're not just doing it from within themselves or their own capabilities. Perhaps they're doing it from what they've observed through others.
I'm sorry, I'll just have to ask you to put the question, please.
Yeah, so at what point does an author have to worry about writing on these difficult issues when they're not that themselves, in the fear of being cancelled?
I'm not in favour of cancelling anyone or anything, and I think that your fellow student has absolutely a point that they can write a racist character, that we see that all the better. Yeah. I think, you know, Orwell is pulling from himself in all his work, a vision that contains, for instance, no female characters of any sort. So there are some very broad brush basic things that you can say about all of his work that reflect on his interests, you know, and I do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Could you all now join with me, please, in thanking Anna Funder for writing this book and for being here to talk about it. And
thank
you all
Nick.
Now have the fantastic opportunity, if you don't have it already, to go and buy it from the book signing tent and have Anna sign it for you. So thank you, Anna, and thank you.